Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Are the days of reliable multi-year economic growth behind us, or can we use smart economic policy to enable American businesses to achieve aggressive expansion? Alarmed by current rates of unemployment, depressed housing values, and growing federal debt to foreign lenders, leaders at the George W. Bush Institute asked a number of noted economists, including a handful of Nobel laureates, to write about what would be required of government and the private sector to reinvigorate the sluggish economy. Brendan Miniter is senior editorial director of the Bush Institute and editor of the new book that compiles those essays, The 4% Solution, Unleashing the Economic Growth America Needs. Brendan, welcome to Think.
Well, thanks for having me.
Tell us first about the significance of that 4% number.
4%, I think a lot of Americans may not realize how significant that is because we've grown on average since World War II at 3%, a little over 3%. So we're calling here for a target, I think, that's significantly above our historical average. And 1% may not sound like a lot, but it's a significant jump. It is achievable, though. We've grown about at 4% or higher at about 23 out of the last 60 years, so a little bit more than a third of the time. And we often grow at 4% or more after a recession. So you need to have this sort of catch-up growth to catch us back up to where we would have been or should be if we'd stayed on the historical average.
So there's good growth and there's bad growth. How do we avoid growing really fast? How do we avoid bubbles?
Well, that's ultimately, I think, a question that a lot of economists have wrestled with for quite a long time. And look, bubbles are very difficult to avoid and to deal with. There are something that come along. They've come along, you know, for 300-400 years in economic history, as far back as I think we can measure. Bubbles are kind of a reality. So you have to find a way to get through it and then grow on the other side of them. One of our chapter authors, Myron Scholes, talks about good growth and bad growth, and points out that a lot of the growth is actually paper growth. It's growth on paper. You know, the housing bubble is a great example of that. You know, if you think that your housing value, the fundamental value of your house, actually doubled in 5 years, you're probably wrong.
But we want to believe that.
Right. That would be nice, you know. Something closer to the historic average, I think, is more accurate to growth in the housing industry, and that's, you know, closer to 2 to 3% a year. So that's good growth. That would be good. So what Scholes points out is that we have to worry about not just growing the GDP or growing housing value. We need to worry about the fundamentals of the economy, and that means creating real value. And what is real value? Real value is when you produce more with less. So, you know, you burn less energy to produce the same number of cars, something like that.
So is government policy useless to sort of create real value as compared with private investment? What's the difference between the two if the same amount of money is spent?
Well, how government money is allocated, it's allocated for political purposes, not for profits or for efficiency. That doesn't mean all of it is bad. I mean, all of it is obviously not. I mean, I think, you know, few people would disagree that we need to have the roads paved, and it's nice to have schools that actually educate children. And there's plenty of uses for government money and plenty of ways it can help the country and help the economy. But it is allocated for political reasons, not for efficiency. And if you want to grow the economy, you have to have a significant amount of the capital being allocated to actually focus on creating these efficiencies. And what are efficiencies? Well, what I mentioned a second ago about producing more with less, but that's kind of a generic term. I think the example that I think is used a lot, and I'll use it here, is the iPhone. You know, that creates real value in the economy. And why? Well, I have an iPhone on me now, so my office can reach me and I can answer questions potentially on the breaks here during the show, and which means I'm going to be doubly productive. I'll be productive at work, and I'll be productive here, hopefully, talking to you and talking to listeners out there. So that's increased my productivity. So that invention out there has created, I think, wealth in the economy. And that was a private investment. That was Steve Jobs popping up and saying, we can do better with this. We can innovate. That wasn't a member of Congress adding a piece of legislation.
Mm-hmm. Of course, I mean, everybody would love to be the next Steve Jobs or invest in the next Steve Jobs. Are there things that we can do, either on the private sector side or on the government side, to pave the way to have more people out there producing at that level of efficiency, of productivity, of profitability?
Well, sure. I mean, look, if I had a magic formula for producing a, 100 million Steve Jobs, I think I'd be very excited and the economy would be much better off. So that level may be, he's a one of a kind, and we understand that. But how do you create public policy that creates a space for entrepreneurs to be entrepreneurial, to innovate? And I think there's a lot of things you can do, and a lot of these things cross party lines. President Obama has talked about lowering the corporate tax rates. I think that would be one way to create capital for the companies that actually are producing the jobs for Americans. Creating certainty is another one. We hear a lot about tax reform right now, a fiscal cliff, all these sorts of things. Basically, what it boils down to is there's about $2 trillion in the private economy sitting on the sidelines right now. One of the reasons it's sitting there is because people don't know where to invest it. They don't know where to invest it in part because they don't know what their tax rates are going to be come January 1st. The law says that they're going to go up. No one really believes all of them are going to go up. So we're going to see which ones go up and by how much, or if any of them go up. So I think a lot of people are sitting on the sidelines waiting to see what happens before they spend their money.
A lot of people say, fine, lower the corporate tax rates, but close a lot of the loopholes or all of the loopholes that exist. I mean, is the net effect going to be about the same amount of payment?
It could be. You could potentially get the same amount of payment, but help the economy. And why? Because all those loopholes, if you're the beneficiary of one of those loopholes, you probably love it. But that often those loopholes don't help the economy. They don't help the economy because they are creating incentives to steer capital in a certain direction, which may or may not help the broader economy, but it might help your business. Or particularly if you're a big business, a lot of those loopholes, a lot of those regulations, a lot of those, even a lot of the taxes on it prevent competitors from popping up and competing with you or offering new products that actually dislodge you from the marketplace. So if you're a big company, often you like those loopholes or you like the taxes or regulations. That doesn't mean that it's good for the economy, though.
So talk for a minute about those economists who by and large, do not appear in this book, who say, okay, 2% is the new normal. That's the best that we can hope for. Why is it that so many people have become convinced that the kind of growth we've seen in years past is either unhealthy or unduplicable in the future?
Well, because we had a bubble. So I think a lot of people look at the more rapid growth and say, well, that brings us to a bubble. Therefore, it's not a good idea.
So all rapid growth is a bubble.
Right. Or will lead us to that. Mm-hmm. They look at the 1920s as another example. I don't think that's exactly right. I think you can grow too fast and you can grow too fast in certain segments. And that's what happened, particularly in credit. And it wasn't just housing, but housing is the bigger piece of the credit that I think it grew too quickly. And we created a bubble. I don't think that the entire bubble was a waste. I think that there was value created. There's a lot more consumer credit now than there was 30 years ago. If you remember, it was a lot harder to get a mortgage or a credit card, in 1980 than it is even today. So I think that those innovations in credit are helping the economy even now. So that's one piece of it. The other piece, though, I think is why do people believe we're at a new normal? I think they believe that because, well, we've been at this for 2 years or about 3 years. We've been at above 8% unemployment here for close to 3 years, I believe, maybe a little longer than that. And you look around and you say, well, we've done everything that we think we should have done. We had a huge stimulus bill. We've given the economy time to repair itself. We've had some clearing in the housing market. So the fact that it's not growing at this faster rate means that it's probably reached its point where it's going to level off and grow at a slower rate. And developed countries actually grow at a slower rate than undeveloped countries. I mean, if you look at China, I think their growth rate is at 8%. It's mm-hmm. down. It used to be above 10%. And the reason is that they're catching up to us. They're copying us. They're looking at our innovations and they're saying, okay, well, we can do that. And just by the sheer magnitude of adopting those things and applying it to economy that didn't have them, you grow at a very fast rate. You can't do that if you're the leading edge of innovation. I think that they're wrong, though. I think we can grow at a faster rate. I think we don't actually know how fast that we can grow ultimately. We don't know what the ceiling is to growth because what leads growth is innovation. So it's in our imagination ultimately. What can we imagine? What can we create?
We'll talk more about innovation in a moment. I want to come back, though, to this idea of comparing the growth of China and the BRIC countries to the growth rate we've seen here. A lot of people are alarmed to see how much faster those countries are growing. And the point comes up in the book that those, no matter what, those economies are still far from catching up to the development within the United States, the level of income and, in fact, of quality of life.
No, that's exactly right. You know, Robert Lucas, one of the Nobel economists in the book, tells a little joke in his chapter about China. He says, if you want to know what it takes to grow at an accelerated rate of 8 or 10%, then you know, grab your populace, lock him in an economy that doesn't change and is, well, he said, lock it in a communist economy for 30-40 years and then open the doors, and all of a sudden you'll see this rapid growth. But what? Why did it grow so quickly? In large part because you left a lot of growth on the table for 30 or 40 years. So you're doing the things you should have done the last 30 or 40 or 50 years, depending on how long you're talking about. But, you know, as I pointed out, China can grow because it can adopt our technologies, because it can siphon jobs from here before it can, because American companies are building factories over there. The same with Brazil, same with, well, the entire developing world. It's much harder to lead the pack. It's much harder to sort of make the huge strides when you have to be the one inventing the new way to go forward, or finding the new efficiencies. It's a lot easier to copy somebody. So what does that mean? Does that mean China's going to catch up to us? Well, yeah. I mean, I guess on the current trajectory, they're growing at a much faster rate than we are. So assuming they don't have a massive recession or don't experience something like Japan has experienced for the last 20 years, ultimately they're on a trajectory to catch up to us. Does that mean they can surpass us, though? That's a different question, right? Because that means they have to start leading the world in these innovations. And are they laying the foundations to do that? I would argue no. I think we still have the strongest college programs here in the world. I think our levels of higher education lead the world, and it's one of the reasons that you see a lot of people from overseas coming here to America. And that's where a lot of innovation is actually taking place. That's where a lot of the idea development is taking place. So until China actually develops a system that can compete with that, I think they're going to continue to lag behind us.
And we continue to be strong competitors globally for sort of the best and brightest immigrants from other countries.
That's true, although unfortunately our visa system is such that they come here, we educate them here, and then we say thanks and send them home. And so they go home and they take the training they got here in America and they build a new company in India or China or in Europe or where have you. One of the things that one of our authors points out in the book is that simply by changing those visa laws, we can encourage growth just by keeping those entrepreneurs here in America.
Does the expansion of immigration, does it make sense to also include in that lower skilled workers, or do we have enough of those to last us?
Well, that's an interesting question. Gary Becker, one of the Nobel economists, has a chapter in the book basically asking what happens when the illegal immigration trails off. And, you know, I think that we've come accustomed, you know, particularly here in Texas, that illegal immigration is a fact of life, and it's a large wave of people that are here. And there are, you know, obviously a large number of low-skilled or even illegal immigrants here in the United States. But there's forces that propel them to come here, and those forces don't always last forever.
My guest is Brendan Miniter. He's senior editorial director of the Bush Institute and editor of the new book, The 4% Solution, Unleashing the Economic Growth America Needs. You can join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the senior editorial director of the Bush Institute, Brendan Miniter. He has just edited the new book, The 4% Solution, Unleashing the Economic Growth America Needs. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Brendan, to what extent can the rate of economic growth be characterized as a national security issue?
Well, I think that question may surprise a lot of people. It doesn't surprise me if you look at the first chapter in my book. I note that late in his term as Fed chairman, DOD actually gave Alan Greenspan a medal, and the reason is that they looked at the economic growth that occurred under his watch and said, thanks to that growth, we were able to have the money that we needed to buy the military equipment we needed to recruit the candidates we needed to train them and to deploy them. And not only that, our economy threw off the innovations that were helpful. And, you know, it doesn't take much of imagination to think how the computer innovations have helped our military, from the drones to the smart bombs to non-lethal weapons, and even to tactics and such that they use. So it's tremendously helpful to have a growing economy. It's much easier to have a strong and vibrant military when you have a strong and vibrant economy.
So does the government investment in, say, military applications and the development of systems that ultimately will perhaps filter down into use by the private sector, is that a justification for keeping military budgets relatively large as compared with other aspects of the economy?
Is it ultimately, can you grow the economy by funding the military at a high level?
The question is, is that a good reason for funding the military at a high level, because there is potentially an economic benefit down the road?
Well, it can throw off economic benefits down the road. I think the internet is one of the examples that people often throw up and say, well, you know, that grew out of a government program that ultimately was based on, you know, for security information and technological development. I don't know if that's quite a justification. I think that it helps to having a growing economy. It helps to have these innovations. I think the military can adopt those, whether they're federally funded or privately funded. The point is, you want to have the innovations. You need to have the innovations. And, you know, there is a crossover there. And I think we don't think about it much now, but there's, you know, a lot of what they used to call dual-use technologies and controlled technologies that we wouldn't let, you know, the Soviet Union have, or we restricted to go to China and other countries. We're obviously, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, less worried about that than the way we used to be. But there is, you know, a cross there where a lot of these technologies that we're developing, we're hoping that other countries don't get because they have direct and you know, significant military applications. So you do have to worry about that. But in terms of actually growing the economy, and is that a reason for keeping the defense budgets, you know, large, I don't think so. I think you ultimately have to worry about the innovations and making sure the innovations are coming, not necessarily where they're coming from.
What can you tell us of those, whatever it is, 23 out of the last 60 years where we've had 4% economic growth? Has there been a shrinking during those periods in the gap in income between the wealthiest and the poorest in this country?
If you look at the numbers over the last 10 years or so, that gap is not shrunk, it's actually opened, right? And ultimately, is that a problem? I think that's an interesting debate. I think it's indisputable a problem if the poor are getting poorer. If some people are really racing ahead, if you have a lot of Bill Gates in the economy that have made tremendous amounts of money, while other people are also, people who are, you know, much lower down the spectrum are also getting wealthier, that's less of a problem that I'm concerned about. Because, you know, I think ultimately what we have to worry about is improving the quality of life of the average American. And if somebody happens to race ahead of it, I'm not too worried about that. What I'm worried about, though, is that everyone is doing better, and we do have to focus on that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Albert in Duncanville. Hi, Albert.
Hello. Say we say the Democrats go ahead and take the presidential election this next coming up season, and we could decide to borrow a little more money from China. What would be the best case scenarios, assuming that we, you know, keep counting on China for financing us, America? in terms of policy? What do you think we can expect in terms of policy coming out, considering we keep counting on those guys for money?
Based on our level of debt to China because of the federal budget deficit, is that what you mean, Albert?
Exactly.
Okay.
Well, the amount of money we borrow from China is problematic. I think somebody calculated that what we're borrowing from China pretty much is our defense budget. So when you kind of put it in those terms, you start to say, well, maybe that's a little bit of a problem. And it is a problem to be too far in debt, and it's also a problem to be too far in debt to one country. I think we can look in Europe and see what happens when you're too far into debt. But ultimately, I think the solution here is I think we do need to curtail federal spending, but I think the solution here is to grow. And to some degree, it doesn't matter what the total dollar number is you owe. What really matters is its ratio to the economy. So if you have a much larger economy and if it's growing very quickly, you can sort of outgrow your debt problem. And I think that's ultimately how we're going to solve our debt problem, by holding spending down or by cutting spending, but ultimately by growing the economy.
So you can outgrow the debt problem if you are able to grow the economy at the kind of rate you're talking about. You also have to ask in these situations about currency value. Talk about the pros and cons of a strong or a weak dollar, given where we are right now and where we'd like to be.
Well, we have a chapter in the book by David Malpasset. He is a strong dollar guy, and he thinks that ultimately if you worry about the fundamentals of the economy, you need to have a strong dollar. And I don't disagree with that. I think inflation has been called the great thief of the middle class, and I think that the reason is that if you have high inflation, it eats away at your savings and eats away at your ability to provide for your retirement, particularly if you're on a fixed income and retired, and you have a high inflation period. You might find that you don't have the money you thought you did to actually live a quality life that you thought, and that's a huge problem. So I think if we let inflation out of the bag and don't control it, it can destroy a lot of it can destroy the economy and certainly have a direct impact on individual lives. That's very destructive, and I hope we don't have to experience that. There is, however, I know there's some thought that the one way the federal government will get out of its debt problem is by inflating its way out, and you lessen the debt if you have some inflation. And there is also a strain of economic thought that's interesting to think about that uses Iceland for an example. If you remember, Iceland is one of these countries that was deep into debt and basically was offered a bailout from Europe because it owed European countries tremendous amounts of money, but on very, very tough terms, and it turned it down. And the European leader said to Iceland, if you do that, you'll wreck your economy for a century and we'll never lend you money ever again. And Iceland voters said, well, that's okay, but we're not going to take the bailout. We're going to take the hit. And they ultimately revalued their currency. And they're now growing at a pretty good rate. They have a pretty healthy economy. They actually have a stronger economy than Greece and a lot of other European countries. So, they were able to use that in order to sort of get around their recession, get through it. And it made a huge difference for them. But it wasn't the only thing that they did. They did ultimately a reform, particularly on spending, cut that way back and reevaluate what they should really be focused on. And they also focused on increasing trade. Trade is actually one of the things that is propping up their economy right now.
Seems like Iceland comes up in a lot of discussions now about what can be done, what can't be done. I wonder, though, the value of using that country as an example. Their population is, what, under a million people total? It's a very small economy in a small country.
It is a small economy. And it'd be like trying to base our economic policy off of what's happening in Vermont or Wyoming, mm-hmm. Great states, but not necessarily representative of the entire country.
Right.
The state that I often hear come up in conversations is, well, energy is something we should focus on. I do think it's something we should focus on. And people point to North Dakota, where the unemployment rate, I think, is 3% right now, and their GDP growth is 7.6%. That's great. That is driven by energy, and I think that we have something to learn from that. It doesn't mean that we can replicate that for the whole country and have 7.6% growth. North Dakota is a small state. It's got a small population. It has a lot of energy reserves that are being tapped right now. That's just not the case for the entire country. So I think there's something to learn from these smaller countries or smaller economies, but it's not you can't completely replicate it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Bert in Dallas. Hi, Bert.
Hi. You know, partisan politics have really diminished the view of the Obama stimulus. But, I believe the stimulus coupled with the auto bailout really saved our bacon from going into another depression. And I just recently read an article based on the book from Michael Grunewald about the New Deal, which really talks about some really game-changing innovations contained within that stimulus plan. And I'd like you to comment on that and just tell me whatever happened to Keynesian economics.
Look, certainly. I think to some degree a lot of Americans wonder what happened to the stimulus bill. It was $800-something billion. It was a lot of money that was spent. It wasn't spent as quickly as I think that people had forecasted or had hoped. We'd spend it, I think, over 18 months, not over the 12 months for the first year. So, and it's not like FDR's New Deal in the sense that we built a lot of courthouses and things that people can drive past and say, that's where our money went. So it's hard to sort of run down and say that's where it worked.
But to interrupt, the money's been paid back.
How so?
A lot of the bailouts have been paid back.
Yeah, a lot of particularly the TARP funding came back. You know, that the first tranche of that $350 billion, that came back in the first year and a half or so. Most of that came back, not all of that came back. Some of the other, but the stimulus bill came then after that. And to look for where that money is, I think it's just harder for Americans to sort of find and point to and say that did it. I think the caller asked a good question. And it says, you know, did that save our bacon? And, you know, it's hard to sort of look around and say, well, you know, this would have happened if we didn't do it.
It's hard to prove a negative.
It's hard to prove a negative. And we didn't have a great depression. I think TARP had a big reason for that. And, you know, I'm glad we didn't have another great depression. My question, though, is what do we do from here? And, you know, will another stimulus package get us to the point where we're growing at a significant rate? I don't think so. I think because we're reaching a point where economists, you know, look at the ratio to debt to GDP, and we're reaching the point where other economies, when their debt had got this high, the debt itself became a depressing factor on the economy. So we run the risk of, I think, running the debt up too high and that becoming itself a barrier to growth.
You talked earlier about uncertainty in terms of tax rates and other things being one reason that businesses are not aggressively investing right now. There have to be other reasons. Talk about what those might be and what we might do in order to get corporations that are sitting on significant piles of capital to put that capital into service.
Well, I think, you know, energy is an example that's worth pointing out. You know, I mentioned North Dakota a little while ago. I think one thing that a lot of people don't realize is that energy costs actually drive a lot of jobs overseas and a lot of factories overseas. We have one chapter in the book, Floyd Kwame writes that, there are what they call lights out factories being built in China. And lights out means there's nobody working there. It's just machines. There's no, you literally don't turn the lights on. It's not labor rates that's doing that. You're not building that overseas because labor is too high, because you're not employing anyone at the factory. You're doing it for lots of reasons, but some of the reasons are often energy. And if you can just lower the cost of energy, you'll bring some of those factories back here. And that will produce jobs here because you have feeder factories that produce materials that go into those factories. And then the tax rates, then you'll also pay taxes on the money raised from those factories here in the United States. So you make your economy better off if you can do that. Lights out factories is sort of an extreme example. But by lowering the cost of energy, you can give businesses a lot of money, a lot of their money back that they can then reinvest into their company here in the United States.
Do we need not just businesses but individuals to spend more disposable income than they save in order to grow the economy at 4% or above?
You know, it's interesting. That's a great debate because I hear this all the time. But if you remember 5-10 years ago, we were complaining that Americans weren't saving enough.
Right.
So before they weren't saving that much, and we complained. And now that they're saving too much, we're saying, well, that's hurting the economy. So what's the answer? It helps when people save money, but what really helps is when people can pool the money up, right? If you spend $10 here or $100 there, that can help, I suppose, in certain ways. But when you have $10,000 to invest to start a business, instead of putting on a credit card to start a business or something like that, you're much more likely to grow the economy. You have to be able to pool resources together to launch something. Businesses are expensive to open. A restaurant, which is, you know, I think a business a lot of Americans turn to, it's very expensive. I mean, the restaurant equipment, you know, stove and all that sort of stuff is expensive. It costs a good chunk of money. That's not just coming out of your weekly paycheck. You have to be able to pool that money together to launch a business like that.
To save until you spend.
Save until you spend. Well, pool it up enough so you can actually spend it to great effect, not just for day to day.
Of course, we also have this tough situation now where it's very cheap to borrow money, but nobody wants to lend it.
Nobody wants to lend it because it's very cheap. It is very cheap, but the lending standards are tougher. I'm not sure that that's necessarily a problem. You know, I think that we saw a lot of particularly home equity loans to folks that that couldn't pay it back or that depended on being able to sell their house at a higher rate in order to pay it back. And that's a problem. I mean, that's just not a sustainable system. And so it's good that I think we've curtailed that.
Do you think that we are done, that the housing crisis is over, and even if we're building back slowly, that is behind us?
You know, housing is a really interesting topic. You know, one of our chapters is written by Vernon Smith and Steve Durgestad, and they look at the housing crisis, and they look at housing in general all the way back to the Great Depression. They look at every recession we've had since then, and what they discovered is housing actually plays a much larger component in our recessions than I think many people have realized. Housing leads us into and leads us out of our recessions. There's only two exceptions between the Great Depression and today where that hasn't been the case.
My guest is Brendan Miniter. He is senior editor of the senior editorial director, of the Bush Institute, and editor of the new book, The 4% Solution, Unleashing the Economic Growth America Needs. Welcome back to the conversation in a moment. You can email us at think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Brendan Miniter is my guest. He is senior editorial director of the Bush Institute, which has just published the book that Brendan edited. It's called The 4% Solution, Unleashing the Economic Growth America Needs. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. And you were telling us about the relationship between housing values and housing rates and historically recessions in this country.
Yeah, this is in a chapter by Vernon Smith and Steve Durgestad. And Vernon's one of our Nobel economists. And when I first asked him to write a chapter, he turned us down. And then he came back and said, well, I've been working on housing. Would you be interested in a chapter on housing? And the short answer is when someone like Vernon says that, the answer is yes. And Vernon's one of these guys who, you know, a lot of economists, I think, deal too much in theory. He won his Nobel for something called experimental economics, where they actually do lab work using real money and seeing how people really react. So it's sort of real-world experience. So I think he's well-grounded at sort of what really happens in the economy. So he and George looked at every recession since the Great Depression, and they found that housing leads us into it. It's actually a better indicator than the business cycle, than business investment. And it's not even just housing, it's actually new housing starts. So if you look at new housing starts, it can give you indication that we're heading for a recession. It also leads us out of the recession. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. It's when people have a job or are optimistic about their job prospects of keeping their job, they're more likely to buy a house or to borrow the money to buy a new house and or sell their old house and buy a new one. So it's a good indicator of also the end of the recession. It's also an indicator of the severity of the recession and an indicator of how quickly the economy is going to start growing. So if you have a quick ramp up in new housing starts, it's a good sign that the economy is actually turning around and about to grow at a pretty good clip, or at least historically has been. There's two exceptions that he found. One was the mild recession after World War II. It's just an anomaly. A lot of soldiers returning from the war, despite the recession, bought homes. The other is 2001, where the housing market powered through the recession. And what happened was we had a tremendous amount of foreign capital flow into the country, and they needed to go somewhere, and it went into the housing market, and is one of the things that fueled the bubble. So what does this research tell us, though, about how to fix the economy now? And it tells us a couple of things. One is that we have to fix the fundamentals of the housing market. We can't just sort of prop it up and expect to get through it. We need to find ways to actually let it clear, get through the woods, get all the way through the woods, strengthen the fundamentals to it, make sure that people aren't borrowing too much or, expecting their housing prices to just continue to rise and borrow against that. But actually, what is the fundamental value to it? And there's a good indicator of that. And we can look at housing values over the last 100 years and see how much they've grown. And it's actually a pretty straight line. And we got far above that straight line in the bubble. But we know where that line is and we can project it and take a good look at that and see if the housing market is about in line where it should be. But the interesting thing about our current recession that Vernon found was that we have interest rates that the federal government constantly lowers in an attempt to grow the economy. Those interest rates are held at a very low rate right now, a historically very, very low rate. But what Vernon found is that the housing is ultimately the instrument that monetary policy applies to the economy. So when you lower interest rates, the biggest effect you have is on the housing housing market. We're not finding that to be the case right now, and that's because I think a lot of people aren't buying homes, and they're not buying homes because we haven't cleared the economy. We haven't cleared the housing market. We're not all the way through the woods yet.
It makes sense that there's no bigger commitment individuals will make financially, other than perhaps having kids, than buying a house.
Buying a house or, I suppose higher education is another one of these larger commitments. But it's not as large as a home. And it's not just the value, the dollar amount involved, of a few hundred thousand dollars or whatever someone is borrowing. You're also often borrowing for 30 years. You're signing up for to stay in a home for 30 years if you got a 30-year fixed rate, or 10 years, or depending on what your mortgage is. And even if you plan to sell it and not be there for 30 years, you're setting up for a long-term commitment and not doing a significant uproot of your life. And that's a real statement about what you believe your future holds.
So do we need to perhaps recalibrate the American dream so that home ownership is not necessarily a requisite component, assuming that people have stable housing and available housing?
Well, that's a good question. I think individuals have to make their own decision about what's good for them and work for them. And there's a lot of debate now about whether there should be a home interest, a home mortgage deduction on taxes, and whether that distorts the market, and whether as a policy we should encourage home ownership. I think we got a little too far in encouraging it in the bubble. I think that's one of the reasons that we had a bubble. And where that number, is of the percentage of Americans who should be, earning a home, I think we haven't discovered it yet. I think it got a little too high during the bubble.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with David in Fort Worth. Hi, David.
Hey there. Thanks for taking the call here.
Sure.
Quick question. The national debt that we have, as a percentage, how much of that is interest versus other items?
You're talking about how much we spend in interest. Is it 14% of the annual federal budget?
It's something like that. I don't have that number in front of me. It's obviously a number. It's a big number to worry about, because the larger your debt is, obviously the larger the percentage is going to be of the interest you're paying. It's like a mortgage that way. And if you get to the point where the interest is so large, and I think this is what the caller was getting at, his concern is that if your interest is so large that that's consuming such a large percentage of the federal budget that it's hard to pay down the principal, or prevents you from doing other necessary things. That's a huge problem, and that's a very difficult problem to solve. That's a pretty steep hole to be in. But I'll just reiterate what I said before. I think the best solution to that is to grow the economy, because if you have a larger economy, it's easier to address not just the principal but also the interest.
We have an email here from Russell who asks, how is the outsourcing of American jobs affecting the economy? Hundreds of my company's jobs have been outsourced to India and China while they lay off loyal employees. Should tax breaks to these companies be cut?
Look, ultimately, I think that we'd all benefit from a flatter and simpler tax system. So if you cut a lot of these tax breaks and reform the system so that you weren't favoring some companies or some behavior over another, I think that the economy would ultimately be better off. I think outsourcing jobs hurts a lot of Americans, obviously. It's leaving a lot of Americans unemployed, and that's something that I don't think anyone should celebrate. I think it's a big problem. I lament to see any job go overseas. I will note, though, that what we need is an innovative economy, and I think that it's very tough on employees, but that's ultimately how you have a strong economy. You have to innovate with it and keep your skills current, and keep your skills not just current for your current job, but transferable to the next job.
Does the public sector really have any does the federal government have any power to encourage innovation? It seems like anybody who's got a great idea and can save money for his or her company is going to do it automatically. Is there something else we can be doing to stimulate innovation?
Yeah, absolutely. And we have a chapter by Bob Lighton that to me was very eye-opening. I don't have the numbers in front of me, so I'll recall them a little bit here from memory. But he looked at it and said, the top 100 innovations 30 years ago, where did they come from? Where was the seed money that led to them? Where did it come from? And, it wouldn't surprise you to know that business, was the vast majority of them. I think it was around 70%, another 10% from government, or 10% from academia and 20% from government, roughly. Today, those numbers are very different. Government share of that innovation has grown, but academia has dramatically grown. And I think it's more in the 40% range now. And business no longer even tops 50% of that. So if you look around and you start saying, okay, so a lot of our innovation is actually coming from academic campuses, from universities, some of which, by the way, are private, but some of which are public universities, state universities. So what can you do to encourage innovation? I would say look at your universities and find a way to change the incentives. Lighton, in his chapter, argues that one way to do that is actually to change the incentives. So if you're a professor who comes up with an idea that can be commercialized, you should profit from it. And there are ways they can profit from it now, but we could dramatically change those incentives so they can more easily profit from it, and not only profit from it and help their current university, but if another university wants to license them, you can change it in such a way that you can make it a lot easier for a professor to bring his idea to a company and then commercialize it, get it out into the market.
The idea being that even if they're in the ivory tower, they wouldn't mind benefiting from this work they're doing.
No, look, absolutely. I think, we're in an information economy. We're in an innovative economy. And, one thing that is occurring, I think, is that a lot of innovation is occurring. The innovation that's really growing the economy, if I mentioned the iPhone, earlier in the show, and it's the example often used. But it's a good example because ultimately, it's something that came out of somebody's head, right? It's an idea that was on paper at some point on a computer screen, probably not paper, and then brought to the market. I think as their economy develops and becomes more specialized and more idea based, you're going to see more and more innovations occurring on a university campus. So if you get the incentives right there, you have a real chance to unleash a tremendous amount of growth.
Interesting email here from Bill in Dallas who asks, is growth in services the same as growth in manufacturing? For example, is a new restaurant as good for the economy as a new factory?
Factories tend to employ, I think, more people than a restaurant.
Unless they're using robots, which
they're
using a lot.
Right. I think you'd have to have a real-world example and compare one to the other. But I will give them a way to think about it. And, you know, I mentioned earlier we have to think about ways to do more with less. So which jobs are we creating that are actually creating new efficiencies in the economy that will then ripple through the entire economy? I don't want to disparage a restaurant. I think a lot of them are great for the entrepreneurs who start them and great for communities where they are and great for the country. And I think that there's a food revolution underway in this country and that, you know, can lead to a lot of innovation. But I will encourage people to think about what is actually going to create the innovations that will then change other industries as well as the industry that it's in. And that could be a restaurant, that could be food. We see it more often in factories and in new startup companies that will ultimately manufacture things.
So to the extent that a lot of people have been disappointed with the economic performance of the entire country over the past years of the Obama administration, I mean, is there any reason to believe that if there is a President Romney, that things will turn around in a much quicker way than they did over the past 4 years?
Well, some of the ideas that we mentioned in the book have been picked up supported by President Obama, such as lowering the corporate tax rate. I think if you did a numbers comparison, you'd see that the Romney campaign it supports or endorses a larger percentage of the ideas that we're putting forth in this book. Romney went so far to say that at the end of his first term, economy would be growing at 4% if he's elected. But you know, if you want me to make a prediction about either who would win or who would be better for the economy, President Bush has made a point of saying he doesn't want to get back into the policy and the politics of it too deeply, and I'll honor his wishes on that, and I'll let the viewers, the listeners, view for themselves when they buy the book and read through it. What I will say though is that I'm very hopeful about America. I'm very optimistic about America. I'd bet on America any day of the week. I think that there are a lot of reasons to think that we can get back to significant growth very quickly. I think we have to get a few policy things right. And I would hope that either party would embrace the policies that would get us there. And I'm very optimistic that, you know, I saw the numbers today that if we don't address the fiscal cliff by the end of the year, we're heading for a severe recession next year. I suspect that that's true if we don't fix that problem. I also suspect that Americans want to fix the problem, and therefore we will fix it.
Brendan Miniter is senior editorial director of the Bush Institute and editor of the new book, The 4% Solution, Unleashing the Economic Growth America Needs. Brendan, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you so much. I had a lot of fun.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can learn more about Think, including upcoming program schedules, and you can download the free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email any comments, questions, or suggestions about the show to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.